Newman of Willingdon Church, and we've just come into the old church, which has perhaps been here for over 700 years. And as we look around, there are bits of all the centuries since the beginning. On the list of vicars over there, there is the name of Godfrey, whose name appears in Doomsday Book, Godfrey the Priest, and we've got most of the vicars from that time to this on our lists. Willingdon is one of the ancient parishes of the Eastbourne district. There was a time when there was only Willingdon, to the north Hailsham, to the south Old Town Eastbourne, to the east West Ham, and over there Jevington. And so at one time the parish of Willingdon stretched right down to the Crumbles and includes a lot of the marshes, Lotbridge Drove and so on. And you can see this on the Ordnance Survey map as recently, I think, as about 1888. The parish of Willingdon stretched from Friston Forest to the sea at the Crumbles. This is one of the 5 medieval churches round in these parts. Now, the church itself is a nave and a north aisle. And most of what we look at is about 14th century. They say that the doorway here is 13th century, and the tower could be 12th or 13th century. We've got no evidence, detailed evidence, of the existence of a church before 1200, and the vicarage was established in 1204. I can tell you who did it, in fact. It was under Norman control. The rector was the Abbot of Grestain in Normandy, and he put in a vicar here, and this was ordained in 1204. And it came under Wilmington Priory, which belonged to the Abbey of Grestain in Normandy, and Willingdon came under the priory at Wilmington, which was under the priory in Normandy, and that's how it is. During the last war, a stick of bombs fell fairly near the church, and most of the ancient glass was blown out. So all the glass we see in the east window and these windows on the south side of the church are post-war modern glass, and the middle window on the south side is the War Memorial window with a representation of the Downs with Babylon and the chalk pit in the middle, and the soldier, sailor and airman kneeling in the corner. Quite a lot of restoration was done after the war, besides the windows. The rude figures were put on the beam. They were done by Ninian Comper and put in a few years after the war. And behind us, the organ gallery and the organ the organ case was got from somewhere else. I don't think it was a new one, but it was got, and the organ was put up on the wall instead of, as it used to be, on the floor. And the gallery for the choir, incidentally, it's not large enough for the choir, and it's rather difficult to sing in, so the choir doesn't often sit up there, was put up with the coat of arms there with the date ER 1953, which is the year of the Queen's coronation. Underneath is the ancient font, which is 13th or 14th century, made, they say, of Eastbourne green sandstone, but I'm not sure that it is. I think the base may be, but it looks a closer stone than sandstone. And if we went round now into the north aisle, we come to the Rattan Chapel, which commemorates the family that lived in the great house under the downs between here and Eastbourne called Ratton, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. Here in the north aisle, at the east end of it, there is what we call the Ratton Chapel. And around us are tombs, memorials going back to the early 1600s, commemorating the people who lived in Ratton Manor, or Ratton as it came to be called. And they were all buried in or around this little chapel. On the left, there is the effigy lying down with his hands in prayer of Sir Nicholas Parker, who died sometime in 1619. And underneath are his three wives. He didn't have them all at once, but he had them one after the other. And there's an account of how many children he had above, and there were quite a number of them. There's also a fine lady here, Mrs. Eleanor Parker, and if you're ever visiting Willingdon Church, it's worthwhile getting someone to read the account of her good deeds and what a wonderful woman she was. The Parkers were here for a good long time, and so their memorials are all over the place, until we get to Sir Walter Parker, Baronet, who died in 1750, and he had no children, so by his death, the baronetage of this honourable family was extinct, and he was the last of the Parkers. And then there came a family called Thomas, who later became Freeman Thomas. And so the other memorials have various members of the Thomas family. There's a window in there in memory of Arthur Goring Thomas, who was quite a well-known musician in the Victorian age. And up here on the right, there is a memorial to the not quite the last of the Thomases, but the man who became Viceroy of India and was given the title the Marquis of Willingdon. And he was Viceroy of India from 1931 to 1936. He lived in Ratton, of course, and his widow survived him for quite a number of years. Above us, hanging from the wall, is his standard, which used to be in St. Paul's Cathedral because he was general or something of the... switch off a minute. The Marquis of Willingdon, PC, GCSI, GCMG, GCIE, GBE, of Ratton in this parish, Viceroy of India, Chancellor of the Most Noble Order of St. Michael and St. George. In the floor here were two little brasses, about nearly 2 foot tall, of a man and his wife of the Parker family. The crest is on the top there. We don't know quite when the lady was lost, so we've only got the little brass of the man in his armour. And people do come here and rub that brass. And there's an inscription below, a square inscription. And this is the only memorable brass we have in the church. There's another crest underneath the carpet here. In the window here are six crests of members of the Parker family, dating, I think, from 1622, the one in the middle, and various members who married, of course, outside the family. There's Parker and Hall, Parker and Levitt, Parker and Hydney. And those may not originally have been in the church. They may originally have been in the old manor up at up at Ratton. But they make quite a nice gold window, and we generally have a gold frontal on the altar here, and we've recently acquired a gold carpet to go with it. In here there hangs a red sanctuary lamp. In front of the high altar there hangs the white lamp, which indicates that the Blessed Sacrament is reserved in the church. And these lights both stay on night and day. And when the white one only goes out if at any time there is no sacrament reserved in the Aumbrey safe. There's a very fine chest in the back here. We don't know, this is probably 14th century. The lid is in two parts, one side will lift up or the other, and presumably they kept their records and things in the chest. There are signs of there having been various sort of locks and hasps on it at different times. We've got a rather ugly looking modern lock and clasp on at the moment because some of our books are kept in there. In the other side, if we open it, we'll probably find a lot of boxes and rubbish. But that's what there is there. Here we're at the steps leading into the tower, and at the moment there are people working on the tower. The clock has been having some trouble, and we had to have some urgent repairs done to it, and we've taken the opportunity of having the winding mechanism electrified so that it'll wind itself instead of somebody taking half an hour to wind it with a great big winder like an old-fashioned mangle.
It
took nearly half an hour to wind up the clock, yes. Two great weights to lift up to the up to the top.
How often did it have to be done?
It used to be done once a week. See, now, if this thing works properly, it'll let the late Govindai Sufa and then wind it up again. You see, it'll keep on doing this. The clock was put in to commemorate Queen Victoria's Jubilee in 1887, and it's got four faces now. It originally had two faces, but there are four. There's a face on each side of the old tower, and the old tower is probably very old and quite a responsibility to look after, really. There are six bells up there, and there's quite a keen team of bell ringers, who many of whom not only ring the bells but also sing in the choir. And
have they got names? Because the old idea is to give each bell a name, wasn't it?
I think they probably got names up there, and I think he's locked the door. But we could there's the picture of the six bells when they were taken down and being smelted or retuned and recast. Yes, they sometimes if a bell got cracked, you can't sort of mend it with sellotape or anything. You have to send it back, and it has to all be melted down and recast in its shape. Goes back to Whitechapel in London, which is, I think, the only bell foundry left working in England at the moment.
Was that done very long ago, the bells, or are they?
Some of them go back quite a long time. If I look in my little book here, I might be able to tell you something about them. The bells... Oh, no, it doesn't say... the bells were cast in 1732, five of them, and the sixth bell was added in 1939. We're fortunate, really, still to have our records with us because we have an archivist who looks after them. And I've got in my hand now the first of the records, which goes back to 1560. Its pages are vellum, and the writing is very difficult to read. In those days, the registers of baptisms, marriages, and burials were just entered one after each other as they occurred. So you get the year 1560 there and 1561 down here. And they have all been transcribed, and we've got a transcription of them so that those who are not skilled at reading 17th century, 16th century writing can read them and consult them if they wish to. And as we turn the pages, so the writing changes, and not necessarily becoming any more legible, but this particular book, oh, it's getting a bit neater there in 1679.
That's a beautiful writing.
You can read it quite easily, you see, buried, Matthew Bunting, March the 29th.
And the vicar's name written.
And yes, yes, Mr. Joe Hill or something. Can't quite read. There's John Jones. But all as we turn the pages over, the writing changes, and there are, see, over a century's births, deaths, and marriages contained within this book. The last year is 1670, and it started in 1560. And we've got the others, the ones that follow on from this. We've got the whole lot right the way through.
That's very nice to keep them in the church.
And it has, of course, as you see, it's been rebound, although the original cover is there inside. Mm. And yes, and it would have had a little thong, a leather thong, to tie it together. But it's lovely to think that for over we've got all the deaths, births, and marriages for 400 years, just in those few books in the safe there. Mm.
That's
and that's where we keep them. Once a year we have a summer fair, and our archivist lays out a lot of our records, not always the registers, but we've got a wonderful collection of photographs sort of going back within living memory. Some of those photographs, in fact, that have appeared in Bill Vine's book on Old Willingdon are in the steel chest there. And we've got this set of pictures, and we lay them all out on the pews, on the sort of book rests and the pews, and on this Saturday afternoon in the summer, when we have our summer fair, when people are tired of buying at the stores or throwing things at the cockshies in the vicarage garden, they come in here and learn something about the old church. And it's a fascinating thing, because many of our people, you see, who've been here quite a long time, says, "Oh, there I am in the Sunday school group." Years and years ago, they got pictures of all the vicars of recent years, you see, in various occasions, great things, and there's a picture of the tower all covered in scaffolding when they last re-shingled the spire and so on, and repaired the buttress. And so we've got this record for historians. It's very interesting just to browse through. I never have time to do it, except on this, if I did some time on this fate afternoon, I can get round and see some of them.
Is that usually in the summer?
It's in the summer, yes. It'll be the last Sunday in July, last Saturday in July this year. And people are fascinated by looking around. We also have our silver. I can't show it to you because it's kept in the safe, but some of the old plate of early 18th century or so, I'm not quite, once again, it'll tell us the date somewhere. Here we've only got the silver that we regularly use. Let me just, you might be interested in seeing this one, which is called the Churchill Chalice, which was bought in memory after Churchill died, and we use it now on Sunday mornings. See, it's called the Churchill Chalice.
How would you describe that?
How would I describe it? Well, it's a sort of base coming up to a narrow waist, a cone coming up to a narrow waist with a knob in it. They call that a knob, I think, in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then the chalice opening out again. I suppose it doesn't, if you hold it half-shut your eyes, it's almost like an hourglass. It comes in and out like that. Mm. But it's a lovely piece of modern silver. And at the bottom it says, "Who would true valour see, let him come hither. Winston Spencer Churchill, 1874 to 1965.
Which is really a lovely piece, isn't it?
It is. Mm. And of course it has a little, what we call a pattern, a little plate that goes on it as well and sits on top.
These are kept in a chamois.
They're kept in a chamois leather
yes, case.
Bag. as these. It's the best way to keep silver anyway, to keep the light off it, and it
doesn't tarnish.
Doesn't tarnish so much. No. You're not supposed to put silver polish on these things. You're supposed to wash them in warm water and soap, because it keeps the sort of proper patina on the outside. Anyway, I'll put that away in the safe.
On top of the safe here, you've got this marvellous desk, haven't you? Very early
that
desk.
That, I think, is what they call a Bible box. We don't use it as a Bible box. In fact, we keep all the bags for the collection. We have so many because you may know that at different seasons of the year, we have different colours. The altar frontal changes and the vestments that we use for the communion change. And somehow, in the past, somebody's provided for us, we provided bags of the different colours to go with them, you see. The purple one, the green one, the red one, and the white one. And so we've got a whole set of bags for the collection, and they live in this converted Bible box, which is probably pretty ancient itself. It's probably... Jacobean.
It's got a beautiful.
Oh no, could be Tudor. Yes, and a lovely old lock. Bibles were first ordered to be provided for each church by Henry VIII in, I think, 1536 or 38, or a date about then. And at that time, many of them were chained, and some of them were kept in Bible boxes. And they're made of different shapes. Sometimes you find a Bible box with a sloping lid so that you can take the Bible out of the box and put it up and read it like that, like a little desk. And they're lovely pieces. In the last church I was at, we had two very nice ones and they were stolen. And we never found them again because I better not put this on. You were asking about the colours. For the ordinary seasons of the year, when there's no special festival or no special time, we use green. That matches the colour of nature outside. For high days and festivals, like Christmas and Easter, and festivals of the Blessed Virgin Mary and other great days, we use white. We very often put on the white for weddings, too. And for saints' days, martyrs especially, and for Whit Sunday, the festival of the Holy Spirit, for the fire, we have red. And for the penitential seasons, which are Advent and Lent, we have purple or blue. The bags here are more or less purple. The frontal that we have on the altar at the moment is blue, but blue and purple seem to be interchangeable for this. For the penitential seasons. And so we've got, when you come into church and see the colours, you're reminded suddenly, oh dear, we've got into Lent. But it provides a sort of changing seasons. When you think that in medieval times, most people were illiterate, and so they learnt with their eyes from what was going on. And this is one of the arguments for stained glass windows. They found some of the stories portrayed in the windows, even if they couldn't read. And there's the importance of the colour that there used to be in the medieval churches. I think we forget that when we read about the Reformation and how they destroyed so many of the images and things that had been in the churches. They were part of the teaching aids of those times, and it's very sad that so many of them got destroyed in the Cromwellian times.
I believe at one time they used to have murals all around the walls of the churches depicting biblical stories so that they could understand these stories, got washed over by the Puritans when they came along.
And they're continually being discovered now. when they redecorate a church, an old church, they're on the lookout for these things. There are some modern ones you may know. Have you been into the crypt of St. Elizabeth's Church?
No.
Because there is a complete set of murals done after the war, or during the war it may have been, depicting Pilgrim's Progress on each side there. And another great example, of course, is Berwick Church, which was decorated with very fine murals, once again, after the war. Berwick, just over there, you know. It's worth taking your machine round to Berwick one day, I think, and having a conducted tour around there, because it's a church that was done up in Bishop Bell's time. He was very keen on this, having this one church with some modern artwork in it. As some people think it's rather gaudy, rather like sort of gypsy caravans, but it is very interesting and very nice.
Very different, yes.
Very different, yes, from what you find. And it's done in a little old church, so it's rather nice to see. We're now in the priest's vestry. That at some time, I don't know how long ago, these two vestries were built on to the north side of the church. A small one, which is called the priest's vestry, and the one beyond is called the choir vestry. We're in this priest's vestry, and as we look at this window here, we're obviously looking at what was the outside wall of the church, and we're looking through a stained glass window, which is not ancient. These also have been put in since the war, one of St. George and the other of St. Christopher, looking through into the church. We can't actually see because it's frosted sort of glass. But in this vestry, the priests keep their robes and prepare for the service. There's a wardrobe there with the cassocks and surplices that we use. This chest contains the vestments, the coloured vestments, which as I was just saying, they change with the seasons. We've got the blue on now at the moment, those would be the vestments we use for the Holy Communion. Here on the other side is the communion vessels prepared for tomorrow morning's service. Under here are the chalice and pattern that we ordinarily use. It's all ready to be for the service on tomorrow morning. In that cupboard we keep the wine and the things we need for our services, the wafers. Underneath are books for different sorts of services, for christenings and funerals and marriages and so on, and other odds and ends, and the wine, the store of wine bottles at the bottom.
I've always wondered about the wine for the church. Is it a special wine?
Yes, this is called Vinum Missale. It's made by someone called Stafford and Company, Lord's Meadow, Crediton, Devon, which is special communion wine, produce of France, it says at the bottom. The tradition, at any rate, mostly in the Church of England, that the wine should be wine and not grape juice, that it should be the fermented wine of the grape. I've also heard it explained that this is partly as a sort of for hygienic reasons, because alcoholic wine is itself a sort of disinfectant, and it helps in that way. But it also obviously the wine that they used at the Last Supper,
yes,
was as it were proper wine, and I think that's another reason for using real wine. Although it's been the tradition in some churches to use unfermented wine, and especially when the tradition is a sort of a temperance one, you know. And I think you'll generally find that in the Methodist Church they don't use fermented wine, they use other wine.
Another point, you call this the priest's room, and I've always thought of the priest as being associated with the Roman Catholic Church, and the vicar or rector, yes, for the Anglican Church.
Well, You want a history on the Reformation, perhaps? But in the Anglican Church, we are still called priests. I was ordained, first of all, a deacon, which is the sort of first stage, and then priest. And we remain priests to the end of our days. The titles that a priest can be given are many and various. I mean, you start as a curate, and then you become a vicar or a rector. Then you might become a rural dean. You might become an archdeacon and a bishop, or you might go to a cathedral and become a dean or a canon, or these sort of things. You see, they're all titles that go above. Basically, every minister in the church, unless he's brand new as a deacon, is a priest, even if he's a bishop or an archdeacon or whatever it is else. And I'm quite often referred to as the parish priest here. And this is the same sort of order as they have in the Roman Catholic Church, as you say, because we believe the Church of England is Catholic as well as Reformed. And some of our prayers, we pray for the Holy Catholic Church, by which we're using Catholic in its original sense, which means universal, which includes the Roman Catholics ourselves and the whole Church of God in the world.
This is very interesting.
The free churches generally refer to them their people as ministers. Though we are ministers too, do you see? And this is, I find this, I believe we're very closer than we were 20 years ago by a long way, to coming together much more closely with both our Roman Catholic brothers and the Free Church. And I look forward, hoping in my time perhaps we shall not be united in one church, but there will be interchange, what we call intercommunion, so that we can go to communion in their churches and they to come to communion in ours. And this is what I hope will happen.
We did a broadcast from St. Andrew's Presbyterian, and you have a liaison with St. John's, isn't it, in Meads, where the vicar or minister... preaches at one, and also the minister from St. Andrew's then goes to the other church.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, this does happen here in this church. We have a united service from time to time. We have a quarterly one. There's the Willingdon United Free Church, the Triangle. There's the Methodist Wish Hill Methodist Church down there. And we do all get together on a Sunday evening, three or four times a year. And on the Sunday in the week of prayer for Christian Unity in January, we had the Methodist congregation joining with us, and they didn't have a service down there, and they all joined up with us, and the Methodist minister preached here. We often, when this happens, we go and preach in a church other than our own. And we are, our relations, I would say, are very happy and good here with these three places of worship, more or less within the parish boundary. And, you know, we look forward to greater cooperation. Just at the moment, we are being faced with enormous challenge in Willingdon Trees, which is an area out towards the railway where hundreds and hundreds of houses are being built, and many of them are in my parish. I'm responsible for it, and we're hoping to be able to get a parish worker to come and live down there and work in that new community, where at the moment it's very difficult for a community to exist at all, because there are no shops, no pub, no public building except the new primary school that was opened this term, and they're miles away from anywhere. Some of the young mothers with their babies, it takes them 20 minutes to walk to the shop, 20 minutes to shop and 20 minutes to get back again, and that's an hour gone just to go and fetch a loaf of bread or something. And I think it's an area which badly needs not just spiritual ministration, but community administration, and we are hoping to find someone, whether it's someone from the Church Army or someone, who can go there and build outwards from that. You see, it's a long way away from our churches.
Yeah, actually, I was surprised to realise your parish should have stretched that far, but of course I can understand it, yes.
Yeah, it stretches right down to the railway, and the north part of Willing Trees, the south part, just north of Broderick Road, it actually falls within Hampden Park parish, but all the north up part there is in our parish, and it joins on to the Hamlands estate, which was built 10, 12 years ago, which also is a very extensive lot of housing. And that's where all the young people live, really, in this parish.
Because St Mary's actually, I suppose, borders on Broderick Road. St Mary's parish.
Now, which do you mean by St Mary's parish?
Hampton Park, by the way.
Because this also is St Mary's church, do you see? It's St Mary's Willingdon, and St Mary's Hampden Park, and St Mary's Old Town, Eastbourne.
Yes.
There are these three St Mary's churches, and it's very confusing, especially as our church and Eastbourne churches are each in Church Street.
Yes.
And we do get... Yeah, well, we had an outing arranged one day. I can't remember what it was for, but we were all out there waiting for the coach to come, and the coach was standing in Church Street, Eastbourne, outside St Mary's Church. And we had to send out a search party for it. But this sort of, and the other confusing thing, of course, is that St Mary's Willingdon and St Mary's Hampden Park both have a vicar whose name is Mr Newman. The vicar of Hampden Park is Dennis Newman, and I'm Michael Newman. So we get our things crossed sometimes, or somebody rings up, and we don't realise until the conversation has got so far that they're talking to the wrong Mr Newman.
It is
confusing, yes. And the only two Newmans in the whole of Sussex, Diocese of Sussex, land up next door to each other.
Is there any particular reason why St Mary's has become a sort of popular name for churches?
No, I think probably there are far more St Mary's churches than any other in the country. Because of the popularity, I suppose, those that go back to medieval times, and when there was a very strong cult of the Virgin Mary, but I think it's a very nice title to have, and we're very pleased to have it. I think there's some uncertainty as to how long this church has been known as St Mary's, in fact. Churches didn't necessarily have a dedication. And some history I read said that it wasn't quite clear how long this church had that dedication. I remember the last church I was at in West Sussex. I think there were signs that it had a double dedication to St Margaret and St Mary. And the St Mary bit had got dropped, and it was always known as St Margaret's. Because this sort of evidence isn't always there in the records, as you do your historical research. It's the Church of Willingdon, or whatever it is, and that's yes. As you see, this church is a fairly small church, serving a fairly large population. This means that we're able to have two main Sunday morning services. In any case, we have the 8 o'clock communion, which might have anything from 30 to 70 people at it. Then we have the parish Eucharist, which is 9:45, with up to about 150 communicants. And once a month we have all the Sunday school in as well with that. And then we have a quick changer with coffee between the two services, and the matin service is at 11:15, which doesn't have quite as many as the previous service, but most Sunday we couldn't get both congregations into one thing because the seating is only about 250 people if they're all squashed up tight. At Christmas midnight we had 350 people in church, and there was standing room at the back here, and you know, it was fairly full. And then we have an evening service at 6:30, which is fairly thin. I mean, you might get 30, but, you know, it's generally fairly thin, except on those evenings when we have our United service and we collect three congregations all together. Now we're in the porch, and sometimes one learns quite a lot from a church porch. You can tell if the notices are very tatty, that nobody cares very well. In fact, as we look round here, we've got a notice here about the Women's World Day of Prayer, which is next Friday. We've got notices about the USPG, which is the United Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, a missionary society which we support, and there are notices about a deanery coffee morning for USPG. We're also in that time of year when we're getting ready for our annual church meetings and our election. So there are notices hereby given about the electoral roll, and nominations for the church council and for the deanery synod, notice of the annual parochial church meeting on April the 5th, and so on. We run in the parish what's called a help group. Here's a notice. This is a group of people who are at hand for needs. One of the main needs is taking people who haven't got any transport into hospital to visit their relatives and things like this. And there's a list of whom you apply to if you need help. We also run a Sunday car service for people who can't. These churches are so often built on the top of a hill, and some of the elderly people don't find it easy to climb up the hill, and so we run the car service. Let's see what other notices there are here. This one has come up from Eastbourne, the Eastbourne and District Christian Education Council, a notice about a centenary meeting and a special speaker.
That's interesting, because again it shows the association with the Methodist Church.
Yes, yes. This is Mrs. Saville's Interlude Singers, who are well known in Eastbourne. They've done a record, and this is a notice she sent me. If anybody wanted to buy the record, she'll gladly sell it to them. There's notice here about the community services in the Willingdon area. This, of course, is the social services generally, and the voluntary and otherwise. An appeal for voluntary drivers from the social services department. Here's our list of sidesmen, the people who are on duty Sunday by Sunday at the different services.
They change every year, or this?
It's revised from time to time, mm-hmm. Yes. The church warden has that in hand, and this is the dusting rota, ladies who come in and dust the church, who notice it's fairly
yes.
clean. There's also a group of brass cleaners who do the brass each week. Mm-hmm. On this other side, we've got a bit crowded up, but there's the weekly list of services, what services are on during the week. A notice about brass rubbing, a notice about the Bible Reading Fellowship, a notice giving the times of the services at Chichester Cathedral, and whatever other notices happen to be going on. We also have copies of the parish magazine down here behind you.
It's a particularly nice one, too.
Yes, we do. We more or less run it ourselves. We buy the covers, of course, and the insets, but we type and duplicate the news. You are welcome to take one of those if you want one, because the new one comes out this next week. But if you like to have it, you may. And the cover, in fact, you find on many other parish magazines as well around locally, because in these days you can only really afford something that is produced in large quantities.
Yes.
It makes a very beautiful magazine.
It makes a nice magazine. It's got inside the cover here, we've got this who's who list of all the people who do it, parish who's who. I mean, if you're trying to find out about a help group or a cricket club or whatever else, you look down there and you find the telephone number to ring up. And there's also, we include the diocesan leaflet, which is the sort of Chichester News, the Chichester News, which is distributed throughout the diocese. And we invite any newcomers, if they want the magazine, to put their lists up, their names up on the list here, and they get the magazine. We've got about 50 magazine distributors, and we print about 850 each. Yes, we always have a few left over at the end, more left over at the end in the winter than in the summer.
Yes.
That's nice. This porch is rather lovely. It's sort of got a barrel vault, and it must be fairly ancient, with this sort of dog toothing or something along the it's carving in the wood on the left there, and that lovely example of a Gothic arch with its sort of mouldings.
And I think at one time there must have been some little faces.
There may have been faces on there.
Looks like
they have been renewed, yes. Mm-hmm. They sometimes had a little face on there, yes. And that, I think, is probably all that I can tell you for now.
Thank you very much for showing us your beautiful church.
It's very nice here. And surprisingly, the church is kept fairly warm. It's cold now, but we have an electric heating from the roof, which I've always been suspicious of when I've seen it in other people's churches. But since I've been here, it works fairly well, provided you've got good socks. Now I think I've said all I can say about this, but I would like to say to those who may be listening to this in time to come, how nice it is to be able to try and paint for you something of this lovely church that I've come to love very much, although I've only been here for 4.5 years. But when you think, from what I've said, that people have been worshipping and ministering here for all these years down through the ages, the whole place, you don't hardly need eyes to feel the atmosphere of an ancient church like this, which is now so beautifully kept and looked after by the dusters and the brass cleaners and all the others. So I hope one day perhaps you may even visit the church and be shown round,